Thanks a lot, Henry. Of course, I'm very happy to be here. Always great to be at Santa Barbara and KITP. So I'll talk about a handful of works that started in at the end of 2016. This is work with Maharoni, Aldai, and BC about computing loop amplitudes in ADS. A paper from last year with these two, and a paper to come out soon with Fernando. And so the title is meant to evoke thoughts about this topic that a lot of us have thought about, I think, in one form or another, which is that in ADS, when we talk about a d-dimensional CFT, we often speak as if the bulk is d plus one dimensional, but if there's a string or M theory dual in the bulk, which the best understood examples have, then there are some extra dimensions. And in the truly understood examples, these extra dimensions are large, that is, ADS-sized, or at least most of them are. And there's been many attempts to understand when you can have small extra dimensions, if you can have small extra dimensions, how common these familiar examples are. And so I'll be trying to shed some light on this using bootstrap techniques, or at least bootstrap-inspired techniques in large-N CFTs. So the idea is to try to understand the emergence of string or M theory in the bulk from this microscopic perspective. And there will be two angles on this that I'll talk about. The first is that, well, you might try to recover something quantitative about string or M theory. And of course, a good place to start is the perturbative regime. You might like to compute string amplitudes, say, in 10 flat dimensions, using holography somehow. And so let us draw sort of a one loop, 4-point closed string amplitude. Say this lives in 10 flat dimensions. This has been computed. This was computed in the 70s by Green and Schwartz. But the status of traditional string perturbation theory is not so favorable as far as going higher and higher in the genus expansion. So the two-loop amplitude is also known for all alpha prime. But at three loops, we know the answer at small alpha prime, but not beyond. That's due to work by Gomez and Mafra. And at genus two, this is due to a series of works by Doker and Fong. And so that is the state of the art as far as the genus expansion. And efforts to go higher are, of course, plagued by the technical difficulty, not to mention some conceptual difficulties, which I'm not qualified to explain. But my expert friends in this field tell me that there are indeed difficulties. So it would be nice to have an orthogonal way to compute string amplitudes, even just in 10 flat dimensions, using non-traditional techniques. So today I'll talk about one holographic way that you might try to do this. I'll stay at one loop, where, as I said, the answer is known, but it's a proof of principle that you might be able to make progress at higher genus. And so the method is, as I've already suggested, to compute these objects in ADS and let the CFT do the work. So if you compute a non-planar correlator in the CFT, say in a strong coupling expansion, this is due to the alpha prime expansion in the bulk, and then you can try to take a flat space limit, which is a controlled operation that we now understand better than we used to, largely thanks to work by Panadonis when he was here, and to recover the amplitude in, say, R10. So today I'll talk about how this works at genus 1. It's successful to some orders in the alpha prime expansion. Of course, the nicest CFT that has a string dual that we tend to know and love is n equals 4 supriangles in 4D, and that's what I will use. And so to compute this ADS amplitude will require some techniques that have been developed in the generic holographic context, which I now think of as the ADS unitarity method, which is a way of computing bulk amplitude without directly computing the bulk amplitudes at loop level, which is to say, by gluing together trees in an indirect way using CFT data. So this is the sort of part one of what I mean by this title. But part two is perhaps a little more sort of exciting and speculative, and that's the unpublished part. And therefore, it's more fun to talk about. And so that's the question of the space of ADS vacua in string and M theory. So for most of the talk, I'll draw ADS as a circle. But for now, let me draw it as a hyperboloid to distinguish it from this sphere or other transverse space. So typically, when we have a theory of two-derivative gravity coupled to matter, there exists an ADS solution where there is some transverse manifold M. And so this would be a solution of some capital D dimensional theory of, say, Einstein gravity coupled to matter. Now, familiar examples have D equals 10. ADS 5 times S5, ADS 5 times T11. You have the ADS 3 times S3 story that has D equals 6. But we'd like to understand better the landscape of these vacua where all the dimensions aren't large, and when this can happen, and why and how it happens. Now, this is hard in the bulk because we don't have full control over string theory at finite alpha prime. So if you want to have a solution where you have some compact manifold with curvature of order the string scale, you need to be able to solve these string equations of motion, which is not something we can do beyond perturbative expansions around supergravity. So I'm not here to try to take a direct approach. There was a paper by Joe and Eva from some years ago that I think is slightly underappreciated, which tries to make a direct attempt at computing string vacua where this manifold is small, which is to say has curvature of order the string scale. And that paper was partly an inspiration for this work. So the question, can M be small, is one that is in principle tailor-made for the bootstrap, because the bootstrap constrains the space of CFTs, which you'll do to the solutions of, say, string or M theory.
Are you going to worry about stability?
I'll mention stability.
Only the superspectric ones will be.
I will mention this at the end, yes. So mostly it'll be implicit in what I talk about, that this solution is stable so that the CFT exists, because I'll be using CFT ideas to infer the existence of such solutions. But I'll be working at a pretty coarse level. So there are various questions in this category that I think are interesting. You know, the first is, can M be small? I think our knowledge of, I mean, personally, I think the landscape of CFTs is vast, and the answer is surely yes. We just can't construct them explicitly. And there are some questions that are a little less ambitious than this one. And so let me just refer again to this N equals 4 situation. Okay, so ADS 5 times S5 is a solution. Now, the S5 has KK modes, and these KK modes are dual to superconformal primary half BPS operators in the CFT. But supersymmetry alone doesn't require the existence of these operators. So you could have imagined that you have some N equals 4 theory where these representations just are not realized by the actual theory. This is sort of another way of saying that we don't have a proof that N equals 4 Subrang-Mills, the Lagrangian one that we know, is the unique N equals 4 theory in 4D, although that's widely believed to be true. So a large N version of this question is, did you have to have an S5 that was large? Now here you have a lot of supersymmetry, and you can argue the answer is yes, but in cases of less supersymmetry, the question of the space of such theories can be phrased as a question about whether you need to have operators that actually realize all of the half BPS representations of the R symmetry. So a coarse-grained version of that question is, given a CFT, what is D? We talk about trying to derive the holographic dual of QCD. Let's just first start to begin by understanding what is the dimension of the bulk dual. How many large dimensions are there? I don't think we have a good answer to that question. It'd be nice to develop some tools to answer it, and that's what I'll try to do today. So uh, So much for the extended introduction. The idea is to try to use loop amplitudes to answer this set of questions as well. So why does that seem like an observable that can come to bear on this question? Well, let's first start by thinking about tree level. In ADS, consistent truncations exist. So you can have tree level amplitudes where there's a finite number of exchanges. And so if you think about tree level physics, you'll never be able to infer the existence of some infinite tower of states. So if you were to just compute some tree level 4-point function, this is not enough to answer a question like this. But at loop level, all of the stuff runs inside the loop. So if you can understand something about the way this observable scales, say high energies, or the way the OPE data that emerges from this observable scales, then you might be able to infer the bulk dimensionality, and that's the philosophy that I'll try to implement. So what's the outline of the rest of the talk? The first is to talk a bit about ADS unitarity method. Then I will apply it to the genus 1 string amplitude. It's derived from n equals 4 Serbian-Mills in the flat space limit. And finally, we'll move on to this part about counting extra dimensions. And if time permits, which I hope it does, the talk will sort of unspool into a series of conjectures or ideas about the behavior of planar CFTs. So conjectures about what kind of holographic hierarchies are possible, some result that comes to bear on the lattice weak gravity conjecture in planar CFTs, and OP asymptotics, again, in planar CFTs. So again, the idea is to use one loop amplitudes to constrain tree level data. So let's try to keep that in mind as we proceed. So any questions about where this is going? All right. Please interrupt with questions at any time. So what is meant by that phrase? Well, it's a method for cutting and gluing ADS diagrams to construct loop amplitudes without having to actually do the bulk integrals. So why are loop amplitudes in ADS hard? Because the propagators are hypergeometric functions, is the short way to put it. You can write down the integrands very easily in position space just by using the bulk Lagrangian. But to actually do the integrals is much harder than in flat space, where when you pass the momentum space, the propagators are just powers of p. In ADS, that's not the case, so it's just technically challenging. That was the reason for the lack of progress over a fairly long period of time when it comes down to it. So what is the philosophy? Well, in ADS, there is no S matrix, but instead you have asymptotic field profiles that source boundary operators. And so this suggests that whatever the ADS unitarity method is, it's best phrased in terms of the CFT operator data. So what does that mean? This kind of cutting and gluing is best defined on the level of the conformal block or conformal partial wave decomposition of some correlator. So if we consider a 4-point function of some operator phi, then at one loop in ADS, which is the first non-planar correction to the CFT correlator, up to some power law of the positions, which I won't write down, we can write this in the OP decomposition as squared OPE coefficients times conformal blocks, which are function of cross ratios. Okay. Now, what actually appears in the decomposition of a one-loop amplitude? The answer is double trace operators. So suppose we have a simple bulk dual like phi cubed, where phi in the bulk is dual to this phi in the boundary, then the CFT has infinite towers of multi-trace composites. So in particular, the double trace operators, phi phi and comma L, are defined schematically in the following way. You have n powers of Laplacian, L open derivatives, acting on two phis, and these act both ways, and you have to subtract some traces to make this a primary, hence the schematicness of this definition. But morally, this is how you define these operators. And so the decomposition here is a sum over double trace operators, or phi, of this form. Now, the dimension of this operator is just the engineering dimension. Plus some anomalous dimension, gamma and L. And this anomalous dimension has an expansion in inverse powers of the central charge. So we can write this like this. So in bulk terms, this comes from tree-level diagrams, this comes from one-loop diagrams, and so on. So the idea of the idiosyncratic method is that this can be determined in terms of this. And the philosophy is just like in the flat space case, given some Lagrangian, you can compute at any loop order the S matrix. And so likewise, that should be true here, but we're going to couch things in terms of CFT data. Okay. So a basic observation is that instead, this is fixed by this. And in particular, it's really fixed by this squared. And this is made manifest in terms of this Lorentzian inversion formula derived by Karen Huo. That's not what we did when we first wrote this down, but it makes the discussion elegant and is useful for later in this talk. So I won't write down the formula in any detail unless asked, but suffice it to say that instead of computing the full four-point function, which at this point will be useful to call a one loop, the statement is that the whole amplitude can be fixed, and there's some asterisk here, by the double discontinuity of this amplitude. Now, what is the double discontinuity? That's the statement that you take this object, and we work in the space of complex cross ratios, and you take a sum of the discontinuities around the branch point at z or z bar equals 1 in one direction and then in the other direction. So this thing is defined as the discontinuity around this way, say around z bar equals 1, if we take the amplitude to be a function of z and z bar, plus the discontinuity in the other direction. So the whole amplitude can be determined by this, and this asterisk is a statement that there's some low spin OPE data that is not totally captured by his formula, but that's just a technicality that, again, is not relevant for this sort of philosophical point I'm trying to make. So the point I'm trying to make, though, is that we can study this object instead for all intents and purposes. And this object is simply a function of the squared tree-level anomalous dimension. So if you compute this, then it's manifestly just a function of gamma 1 squared. And from that, you can derive the one-loop data like gamma 2. OK.
Can I ask a question?
Please, please, yeah.
The Borg speak about discontinuity, or is it something more messy than Borg?
So, good. So let's ask, what is the double discontinuity of something of this form? So the double discontinuity of something like this form, where n and m are integers, goes like log, so the whole power comes along for the ride, and you get a log of m minus n to the minus 2, 1 minus e bar, plus dot, dot, dot. So in particular, a single log times an integer power is killed by the double discontinuity, but a double log is not. And that's actually exactly why this object is fixed by the square of the tree-level anomalous dimensions, because every time you bring down a power of the anomalous dimension in the conformal block decomposition, it comes with a log of the cross ratios. So the terms that are squared are not killed by this object, but the terms that are linear, like the new contribution in one loop, is killed. So if we were to write this thing out, and I will have to because it's going to be central to what we talk about, in a simple theory like phi cubed, where all you have is this set of operators and some other theories that are relatively simple like that, this takes the following form. So these are the squared tree-level anomalous dimensions. These here are the squared mean field theory OPE coefficients. So the OP coefficients appearing in the four-point function at c to the 0, the disconnected piece from the ADS language. And this is the conformal block for the exchange of these double trace operators. So this object is manifestly just a function of the squared tree-level data. And so it becomes clear that the one-loop data is fixed by the square of the tree-level data in this sense. If at this point you're wondering, well, is that theory like phi cubed too simple? Is it more complicated than that? For a completely generic theory, it's slightly more complicated. But for n equals 4 at strong coupling, it actually is essentially no more complicated than this, as we will discuss. So this is sufficient for the purposes of this talk, as I'll try to justify.
So in principle, are the higher loop terms in gamma also determined from gamma 1, or do we not know?
Yes. So. If you proceed iteratively in loops, then you would compute gamma 2, the one loop dimension, in terms of gamma 1 squared. Then at two loop order, the two loop anomalous dimension will be determined in terms of gamma 1 cubed, but also a term like gamma 1 times gamma 2. But you already know gamma 2, so you have that information, and so you just keep going. I mean, so now it's worth drawing a picture, which is what I was going to do. Right, so this is meant to be the CFD implementation of the following cutting of the bulk diagram. We think of this as essentially a gluing of two trees.
So you could essentially have all the single traces at one loop.
So, single traces always appear at leading order at tree level. I mean, just due to large n counting. It's true that at one loop you might get a renormalization of the OPE coefficient, and I'm not writing that here. So I'm assuming, for the sake of this formula, that the OPE of three single trace operators is exactly of order 1 over root c. But there are, in addition to this, terms that renormalize the tree-level amplitude, but they're a little boring, so I haven't written them. Okay. So this is the general picture. Now you might ask, if the bulk theory is divergent, does this still hold up? How do you see this in the CFT data? That's a frequently asked question. And the answer is that, there's an intuitive picture, which is that in the bulk, if you have a divergence, to cure it, you add a local counterterm. And local counterterms generate OPE data in the CFT for double trace operators that are bounded in spin. This follows from this Hames-Kirk et al. Paper, which is by now famous, coming out of here. Okay, so the double discontinuity is finite. The terms that are UV divergent are annihilated by double discontinuity because it's analytic in spin, and those terms are non-analytic in spin. So that's another reason why it's a nice object to study. That's the first point. And the second point is that you actually can diagnose the degree of the divergence by looking not at the double discontinuity, but at the full amplitude itself. But I won't explain that. But you can indeed see that you need such counterterms if the dimension is sufficiently high. given some tree level data. So there's a nice separation between going to loop level and extracting the finite pieces versus the sort of divergent pieces. Okay. So now let's think about all this in the context of n equals 4 super Yang mills. And I realize before I proceed, I need to make one remark. So this might not have been clear, but it's important that in, say, the T-channel expansion of some correlator, so T-channel means expanding around Z and Z bar equals 1, that this, if given some operator exchange in the four-point function, it contributes like 1 minus Z, 1 minus Z bar, all to the power of the dimension of that operator minus 2 times the dimension of the external operator phi divided by 2 times higher integer powers. And actually, really, this is the twist, which is the dimension minus the spin of the intermediate operator. And so if this operator has dimension 2 delta phi plus an even integer, then the double discontinuity will annihilate this term because there are no logs, and this is an integer, so the double discontinuity kills it. Okay, so that's why you get this behavior. This will be relevant starting now. Okay. So computing one-loop amplitudes in planar n equals 4 at strong coupling is just a souped-up version of carrying this procedure out in something like a phi-cube effective theory in ADS. Okay, so we're going to work in the 1 over C expansion and also in the 1 over lambda expansion. Of course, this is dual to the low energy expansion in the bulk. And so if we again draw the schematic genus 1 string amplitude in ADS, then in this expansion, so this is order 1 over C squared, if we expand this in large lambda, that is to say, small string length in ADS units, then the leading term is just what you get by doing supergravity, 10D supergravity. And then you have a sum over contractions of these into quartic vertices, which are the stringy corrections descending from the 10D action. So you have triangle diagrams, and you have bubble type diagrams. And each of these quartic vertices is associated with the S5 reduction of an r to the fourth term in the 2B action. So we have a sum over diagrams like this, where this vertex is associated to a d to the 2k, r to the fourth vertex in 10D. And likewise here, we have contracted both sides. And the higher order you go, the more powers of alpha prime there are, which I've suppressed. So we'll be, from the CFT side, computing this expansion effectively in the bulk. So what is the spectrum of the n equals 4 theory in 1 over lambda perturbation theory? Well, the single trace spectrum is quite simple. You have the superconformal primaries. Let's call them OP. So these live in the 0P0 of the R symmetry, which is SU4. And the dimension is just P. And that's all in the single trace sector. These, in addition to their superconformal descendants, of course. And then you have their composites. So we have things like OP, OP, and comma L, which are the double traces I wrote before. But now there's an infinite set of them.
So P equals 0 is the dilaton, and then everything else is completely minor on top.
Sorry, so P is greater than or equal to 2. The dilaton is a Lagrangian operator. Dual of the dilaton is a top component of this multiplet with p equals 2. Yeah, so indeed, we'll study the four-point function of R2, where R2 is just the 20 prime, which lives in the stress sensor multiplet. Yes, please. At tree level, you mean? Good. So some of them are positive and some of them are negative. Most of them are negative, I think it's fair to say. That's something that I have to check. Yeah, so the basic story is that if you didn't have supersymmetry in any of the fancy stuff, it would be negative by the attractiveness of gravity. Here, in supergravity, it's not so obvious. And so some of the dimensions are positive, some are negative. It depends on P and on N. This was articulated most clearly in some work by Heslop and Drummond and Paul and April from a couple years ago. Good. OK. Good. So the good thing about this this regularity of the spectrum is that the double discontinuity of the one loop amplitude is indeed completely fixed by the square of the tree level anomalous dimensions for all of these composites. Okay. So in the 1 over lambda expansion, the tree level dimension, I'm going to write it like this. So it's going to be the 1 stands for tree level, and then it's going to be a bar. And this is meant to denote the supergravity contribution to the anomalous dimension at tree level. And then at higher orders in 1 over lambda, there are these stringy corrections to this object. Okay. And so our goal, if we're trying to compute stringy corrections to this one loop four-point function, is to compute the sums that appear in the double discontinuity, which is fixed by the square of these guys in the 1 over lambda expansion. So if we define this object to be 1/8, and make a sum over all the double traces, we have the field theory OPE coefficients, and we have the square of the anomalous dimensions, where they're labeled by what order in lambda we are when we take each copy of gamma in this sum. So this x bar y means we take the x term in this expansion, and we multiply it against the y term, and we try to perform this sum. Okay. So of course, everything here is a function of n and l. So there are sums to do that depend on 1 over lambda. So this is just very simple to organize. And these are superconformal blocks, hence the hat. There's various technology that is not worth explaining in this talk, where you can just take advantage of the n equals 4 supersymmetry to make life simpler, and you just have to work with the superconformal primaries, blah, blah, blah. But what is the bad thing about this, this simple, strongly coupled spectrum? The bad thing, which actually will turn out to be good, is that there's mixing amongst the composites. So if you take this double trace operator of O2s, and this mixes with the double trace operator of O3s, you decrease the value of n by 1, because these have the same conformal dimension at infinite central charge. These brackets are meant to denote the average when you sum over all of the eigenstates appearing in this four-point function. So one has to process that in the 1 over lambda expansion. Now, at infinite lambda, there was a paper by Aldaya and Caron Huo that carried this out, just recovering the supergravity one-loop amplitude. So what we're doing is this part, but the upshot is that we get to access the stringy terms in the genus 1 amplitude, and as I tried to motivate at the beginning, going to higher genus in particular, that is a promising avenue. Okay. So Having performed these sums, the next step is to take the flat space, or both point limit of the double discontinuity of the amplitude. So this is something that people are probably somewhat familiar with. Schematically, it's an analytic continuation of the Euclidean correlator to a scattering process that localizes the interaction point in the bulk to a point, or really down to of order L string. And this corresponds equivalently to taking your ADS amplitude and taking the ADS radius to infinity, which is sort of the opposite of focusing the interaction. You just take the whole space to be large, and the interaction happens in some region that's locally flat. So morally, that's what this achieves. And how to take this limit on the level of a bulk CFT correlator is something that is understood, largely due to Panadonis, as I mentioned. So this procedure easily gives you the leading power of S, the Mandelstam S in your string theory amplitude in flat space, at each order in 1 over C and 1 over lambda. Okay. So, having computed the double discontinuity of this one loop amplitude, you take the flat space limit, and what this recovers for you is the discontinuity of the genus 1 string theory amplitude. And as for understanding why this is the case, you can think about it the following way. The double discontinuity is sufficient to recover the full amplitude in the CFT, in the same way that dispersion relations allow you to recover the full amplitude from the discontinuity. And when you take the flat space limit, the CFT amplitude turns over to the flat space S matrix. And so Aldan, Karen, Huo showed that that sort of process of taking the flat space limit and taking these discontinuities commutes, so you can just work directly in the level of the double discontinuity, matching it to the discontinuity. So what this most easily gives you are the non-analytic pieces of the genus 1 string amplitude. And now we can study this in the alpha prime expansion and match to what we get here. Yes?
When you say you can localize to a point, the bulk lines are null, I suppose. So if you want to localize, I'm just thinking the points in the bulk that are null related to a point on the boundary is a codimension on surface. And so to localize to a single point, I think you would need 5. The bulk is 5-dimensional. You would seem to need 5-point function to get uniquely a point in the bulk null related to the 5 boundary. So there must be something more that goes into localizing a bulk point, a four-point function.
Scattering on the curve point.
Oh, it's conservation of momentum.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? OK, so this is how it's done. The reason I'm spending a fair amount of time on how it's done is, well, besides because I think it's interesting, is that the matching in the end is just I could write down the terms for you here and tell you that we reproduce them, and that's not super exciting. But that's what happens. So again, this was computed in the 70s in a paper by Green and Schwartz in one of their first string theory papers. And it's a SL2Z modular integral. And it can be expanded in alpha prime. So for instance, the S-channel discontinuity of this genus 1 amplitude at order alpha prime cubed, or to the fourth, rather. Let me just write one term. This is minus 2 pi I times 4 pi zeta 3 over 45 times alpha prime S over 4. to the fourth. And that is something that you can match using this technique. So let me now segue to the counting extra dimensions part by noting an interesting feature of this calculation. So rather than match the amplitudes themselves between the ADS5 and the flat space, you could have tried to match the coefficients in the partial wave decomposition. The dictionary for doing that has also been worked out, but it reveals something interesting when you think about it in the one-loop context. So the relationship between, so what is the picture? So if we go over here, in the situation where the amplitude is controlled by the sum over these double trace operators, these are dual to two particle states in the bulk, where this quantum number little n is like the radial quantum number of this bulk wave function. Now, when you take little n to be large, you're focusing a wave function into the center of ADS. And this is consistent with the fact that in the bulk point limit, the conformal block expansion is being taken close to its radius of convergence. And so singularities appear from the tail of the sum, in particular the sum over n. So it's the large twist, the large little n double trace OPE data that's controlling the bulk point singularity for you. And the relationship between the ADS radius, the Mandelstam S in flat space, and n is like this. Now, in n equals 4, super Yang Mills, if we look at the tree level anomalous dimensions at large little n and spin L, they scale at strong coupling like n cubed. This is meant to be n to the d minus 1, which is the scaling of any strongly coupled CFT with an Einstein gravity dual. Here it's 3. Now, this obviously implies that when I square this, this goes like n to the 6th. However, we had this mixing issue, which meant that we summed not just over this one family of operators, but this infinite set of double traces coming from all the KK modes. And after mixing, you find that this sum over all of those squares scales like n to the 11th. Okay, and as we all know, 11 is 6 plus 5. And 5 is the 5 of S5. Okay, so this was observed in this paper by Aldai and Karen Huo when they thought about this in the supergravity context. But what I want to do is to try to abstract away from n equals 4 and understand the property of the discontinuity of the one loop amplitude for general space-time dimension capital D and see if you can infer capital D, the number of large bulk dimensions, from the behavior of the CFT data at large little n. So that's the idea. So let's count. Dimensions. So now, let me just say for the rest of the talk, as I have been already, I'll be working in the context of CFTs with large n and a large higher spin gap. This is the abstraction of strong coupling that was suggested to us by HPPS for the emergence of a local bulk dual. Now I want to understand local in how many dimensions. So we're going to be assuming these properties of the CFT. And we're going to imagine that there's a two-derivative theory of gravity plus low-spin matter that emits a solution like this. It can be a warped product. It's not critical that it's a direct product. So the amplitude in d dimensions, say for a four-point amplitude, perturbatively in G Newton, take the following form. You have some tree-level piece, which is genus 0, a one-loop piece, which is a genus 1. And now if you want to express this as in D plus 1 dimensional language, well, this is large. So here, Lm is of order LADS because it's a solution of 2 derivative gravity. So if we divide by volume of M, we can just re-express this in terms of the D plus 1 dimensional Newton's constant. And if we write that in CFT language in terms of the central charge and the ADS radius L, which I'll just call L without the ADS subscript from now on, you have the following type of expression. So this is just dimensional analysis, but the important point is that this is the power of L appearing here. And so for now, without so much rigor, motivated by this relation, this seems to suggest that in a CFT with a capital D dimensional two derivative dual, a large little n behavior of these squared anomalous dimensions should scale like this. Of course, this is what happened in n equals 4. And so the proposal is to sort of use that as a diagnostic of what capital D is. So just to identify something in the CFT that allows us to read off how many large bulk dimensions there are. So let's make this a little more rigorous.
What's D? The total dimension?
Yeah, so, sorry. So,
so
capital D.
I understand 6 plus 5 is equal to D plus little d minus 3.
Yeah, so this is 10.
Okay.
That's 4.
Okay.
So capital D is the number of large bulk dimensions.
Including the D of D plus 1 of ADS.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So capital D is the dimensionality of the two derivative theory that hosts this solution, where this is large. Right? It has to be large because I'm assuming that the bulk theory here is two derivative by virtue of the CFT having a large gap, and so it better not have string scale curvature. It's just not allowed. Okay? All right. So let me check the time. Good. So we're going to be a little more rigorous by just observing what the general form of the double discontinuity of a one-loop amplitude or a one-loop correlator in a planar CFT at large gap looks like. And it will turn out to give us a prescription for reading off the number of large bulk dimensions and to understand what is responsible for D. Okay. So we're going to look at some four-point function, four phis again, and one loop. So we can call this A one loop. Now, the OPE of phi with phi, that's the identity, and then a bunch of other single traces, phi prime, and then a bunch of composites, and so on. There are two categories of operators that are appearing here with respect to their contribution to the double discontinuity of the amplitude. The first are operators where delta prime, the dimension of phi prime, is equal to the dimension of phi, which I'll just call delta, plus an integer. The second, and here I'm simplifying to scalars. These can have spin. Really, then there would be the twist that appears here. But for the sake of this discussion, let's just pretend they're scalars. The second are operators whose dimensions are not shifted by an integer from that of the external operator. Okay. Now, when this happens, these operators, so at one loop, it's only double traces that are appearing. When this happens, the double trace of two phi primes mixes with the double trace of two phis. So we have double trace mixing. And the contribution of an operator like this is just by way of the square of the tree-level anomalous dimension of the type we discussed before. When phi prime has a generic dimension that's not shifted from that of delta by an integer, then its double traces don't mix with the double traces of phi, and it just contributes to the amplitude of one loop as if it were like a single trace operator. So it contributes to the double discontinuity in particular, not by way of the anomalous dimension, but just by way of some OPE coefficient. phi prime, and L squared. And again, here the key, just technical thing that you want to keep in mind is that these operators, any operator appears like sort of delta hat minus 2 delta phi over 2 in the T-channel decomposition. So when this appears not an integer, the double discontinuity doesn't kill it. And that's what happens for this set of operators. Okay. So you want to think of these as like generic single traces, and these as single traces that are somehow regular with respect to the dimension of phi. And so this allows us to write down the general double discontinuity of a one-loop amplitude. And there are two types of contributions. So let me just write this formula. And then I will explain it and explain its virtues and wildly extrapolate from it. I think it's worth writing this down. So we're going to have a sum over all the single trace operators, phi prime, appearing in the OPE. Sum over N and L, which are the double trace indices. We have some object alpha N and L times the conformal blocks for the relevant double trace operators. And the point is that alpha N and L is the following. And then that'll be it for the sort of technical part. Okay. So operators in category 1, so let's look at this formula. This is the contribution of squared anomalous dimensions due to the phi prime operators. And those contributions come from these dimensions, which are regular with respect to phi. This is just the single trace density of states times the squared OPE coefficient times some factor which comes from the double discontinuity. And these are the operators in category 2, the generic ones. So this is a powerful formula. And let me explain why. So what are the properties? The first. Positivity. Alpha is positive, and it's manifestly positive. This thing is squared. That's a squared OPE coefficient. This is squared. It's the density of states. That's squared. Okay. This allows us to bound D, capital D. Because if we look how this scales at large little n, then using the arguments I gave before, you get some estimate for the contribution of those operators to capital D. And because of positivity, that can't be canceled by something else in this sum. So this allows us to bound D. Okay. So in particular, suppose you just have a regular spectrum without all these generic pieces. Then this average, I'm going to just drop this A naught for sake of gravity, this average, large little n, scaled like this. And now we're looking at a positive quantity. Okay, so given these in some CFT, you read off how they scale, and you get to read off d, or at least a lower bound on d. The second point is just sort of a philosophical one, which is that we're getting tree-level constraints from the one-loop amplitude. Okay, this is a sum over single-trace data. Or these are squared double-trace anomalous dimensions, but what's appearing here are the data of the single-trace spectrum. And finally, sort of in connection with this, we can bound the single-trace growth and infer various properties of OPE data in planar CFTs. So I've got about 5 minutes. Is that accurate?
Yes.
All right, good. So let's talk about some results. So, this piece, what's relevant here is the growth at large dimension. You're summing over operators with dimension delta prime, and so it's the asymptotic to the sum that control the dimensionality of the bulk. So, if this grows polynomially with some power k, then you infer from this rule that d equals d plus 1 plus k. This is the reverse of something we all know, which is that if you have a large manifold M, then the asymptotic growth of eigenvalues is controlled by Weyl's law to be the eigenvalue to the dimension of the manifold. Okay, rather it's the and so since the eigenvalue is like the mass, which is dual of a conformal dimension, a large dimension, you would recover this result. The thing we're doing here is doing an inverse. If you have a CFT where the single trace growth is power law like this, then you can read off the bulk dimension from this formula. So now if we focus on the integral towers, the regular piece, then we're looking at something closer to n equals 4. So suppose there exists some tower OP, where the dimension of these guys is the dimension of delta plus p. So you have one at every dimension shifted from that of the external operator. What is d? Now you might guess d is little d plus 2, because you've added a single s1's worth, if you will, of operators. But now we can derive that. So the contribution to d comes from the sum over p of the contribution to the anomalous dimension squared from the pth operator. Okay. Now, how do you derive this? You derive this by looking at four-point functions phi phi p p, which helps you deconvolve the mixing matrix of these double traces. And this, holographically, is a sum over diagrams like this, plus the U-channel. And you notice that this diagram here, which is the one that ends up giving the major contribution, is proportional to, so if there's a P exchange here, proportional to C phi PP. So it turns out that this thing is controlled by the large P asymptotics of this OP coefficient. So we're going to sum over P. We do this in a limit where little n's becoming large and little p's becoming large. So really, this is going to be some integral n of gamma n l squared, which is a function of n. And this thing behaves like C phi P P, really, like n, I suppose, squared times n to the d minus 3 squared. That's not supposed to be obvious. This is a result of a calculation. But you see that it's the asymptotics at large dimension of a light, heavy, heavy three-point function in a planar CFT that's controlling the number of bulk dimensions that emerge. Now, if this three-point function at large dimension goes linearly, then capital D is D plus 1 plus 1. So the natural number of dimensions you would grow by adding a tower of operators seems to be reduced by taking this OP coefficient to grow linearly. Now this is natural from the perspective of thinking of phi as, say, in the stress tensor multiplet, where the Ward identity determines this to be proportional to n, the dimension of this operator for all n. But in general, it seems that this light, heavy, heavy three-point function in planar CFTs is controlling the number of large space-time dimensions that emerge. So I'm basically out of time.
Right, but these heavy ones are also kind of light in the sense that they're not big ones, right?
Absolutely, good. So I have been exceedingly clear. So the operators I'm talking about here, so good. This is a three-point function of some light operator phi, and then it's some operator OP, OP. And we take the dimension of P to be much greater than 1, but much less than the other scales in the problem. And in particular, here I'm working at large n and large gap. So this is much less than, say, delta gap, the string scale. So these are like, you know, heavy chiral primaries, but not string states. And the reason I had to take large gap is just so that when I take large little n, I don't have to worry about a crossover, because I just want to be sensitive to the large dimensions, not the small ones. So in view of time, which is gone, let me just make a few more remarks. So if these operators OP are charged under some global symmetry, then the number of dimensions can be greater than this. N equals 4, you have a single tower of operators. They're charged under SU4. So if you ask that they be charged as rank P symmetric traceless tensors under, say, some SON symmetry, then dimensionality, say it's SOQ, just because we already used N and P, then in that case, the dimensionality is D plus Q. And this is exactly the dimensionality of this spacetime. Okay. So we're able to reproduce all the maximally supersymmetric cases. But also, I mean, more interestingly, to give a characteristic number of bulk dimensions to theories of less supersymmetry. Crucially, it depends on the scaling of this OP coefficient. But if we assume it to be linear at large dimension, then you recover the statement that, for example, if you have a single tower of operators in a 4D n equals 1 theory that have regularly spaced U1 charges, then the bulk dual is, say, six-dimensional because you have an S1 and no more than that. Okay. So, of course, this is intuitive, but again, the point is that we're going from the CFT side into the bulk, whereas it's the opposite that is the thing that we think we know. And so let me just make one last comment, which is that you can turn the logic around. So having identified this OPE coefficient as partly responsible for the number of large bulk dimensions, you can say, let me insist that the bulk doesn't have more than 10 or 11 dimensions, because I believe that there is always a stringer M theory in the bulk. Then you can bound the asymptotic growth of this coefficient. And by this kind of argument, you can also argue that the linear growth is natural because it gives you the number of dimensions you expect. And this leads me to a conjecture that in planar CFTs, if you look at light, heavy, heavy three-point functions where the heavy operator is much less than the gap scale and n, that it grows linearly in the heavy dimension. This is not something I've been able to prove. I think there should be a world sheet argument for this. But that's a new statement that would be interesting to try to prove. And I'll just conclude there. I'm happy to expound upon any number of conjectures if asked, but the talk's over, so let me just stop.
Having more than one extra dimension here, was your argument involved having some currents going on, or at least this is one way of seeing it. Are there any comments on having a situation where there's more dimensions, but they don't have any necessarily have any symmetry, so there's no extra currents, but nonetheless they're big dimensions?
I don't think this is possible, actually. I don't have as much behind that statement as some of these other ones, but one way to phrase that is to ask, suppose you have a theory with large higher spin gap and no global symmetries. What is the dimension of the bulk? And by dimension, I mean large bulk dimensions. I think the dimension should be D plus 1. And this is a kind of modification or follow-up to a conjecture made by Eva and Jill. They said strong coupling plus no R symmetry should mean local D plus 1 dimensional dual. It's not clear at that point what strong coupling means. There are plenty of theories of the large higher spin gap, but where the bulk dual is local in 10 dimensions. And it's not just because of the symmetry. So an interesting example are these, this ADS5 times T11 case. This is dual to the conifold. That's a 10-dimensional bulk dual, but it's a 4D n equals 1 theory. So somehow there are lots of extra states. And we know this from the KK analysis, that there are lots of unprotected operators that nevertheless have order 1 dimensions. But that's not generic, and you might argue that it's due to the fact that there are isometries in T11. Not just a U1, it actually has even more than that. So it actually seems to me that whenever the bulk manifold has isometries, that's what's protecting the emergence of large bulk dimensions, whether it's an R-symmetry or something else. And so I think that this formula helps substantiate that belief, because it gives us a way to quantify that. So now, one last remark is that actually, if you ask, do there exist Einstein manifolds with no isometries, there are no known examples that are not from orbifolded. So it actually might be that there are no such manifolds, which would make an interesting connection with this intuition about strong coupling, but that's my belief about that topic.
Sorry, you want no local isometries. Is that the idea? You can break them by some global identification. And by Einstein, you're restricting to positive curvature?
Yes. Excuse me. Thanks. That was implicit, but it's important to state that, yeah. So, I mean, no Calabi-Yau, so, of course.
For example, you might have, if there's ADS 3 times S3 times K3, mm-hmm. K3 could be big or small, but you might not have any isometries. You wouldn't be able to tell by currents or that.
Yeah, so, I mean, right, the K3 is, we take it to be small, typically, and there are no isometries, so that example doesn't help here, but when we talk about determining the bulk dimension D, there could be other string scale compactified dimensions, but we're sort of imagining that's already been done, and we're trying to just infer the number of large dimensions, because that's what survives after you take the large gap limit. That's the way to say it.
Sorry, I was thinking of when the K3 is large, then it's not currents on everything. It's just
yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, please. Yeah.
There's these examples where you take these trust interactions, for example, where you take four, we know that those break along the solid trees, but we still don't have some solution with this type of stuff. They're telling me that I can understand that. Example, all these rules would say that this is not fundamentally doable unless one can state it because broken dimension is in the tree. So the big question is, in the sense that there exists perturbative things that are near one of these things, how does that analysis help you?
So in that case, typically, the growth of single trace operators with dimensions that are not shifted from some other operator by some integer is going to tell you that there are five extra dimensions emerging. S5 is highly symmetric. Once you take some of that symmetry away, you get lots of operators whose dimensions aren't perfectly integral. And so I think in that case, that's what's buying you the extra dimensions.
Okay, so then there's a question that when we take these deformations to be large, you really expect this thing to be called string size. So how do you make the transition?
Yeah, I don't have much to say about when you start tuning things to be string sized, because in interpreting this formula, I'm thinking of string L to be large from the outset. What happens there, though, is that so in the same way that we're probing OPE coefficients in this range, if you think about the double trace dimensions at large little n, you don't want it to be too large. At some point, you'll exceed the scale associated, the string scale. And then once you go above that, then you'll be able to see all 10. But once you're below that, presumably you should only be able to see however many are large. I don't have an understanding of what kinds of crossovers are possible in this OPE data, but the statement is just that there should be one, and if you had control, you would see it.
Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Eric again.